the Double Loop Podcast, your source for everything about fingerprints. While you're working on your comparisons, we'll talk about comparisons. I'm Eric Ray.
And I'm Glenn Langenberg.
All right, Glenn, we're continuing on our streak here. We've got lots of episodes lined up for the year. I think this might be our most consistent year in quite a long time. I'm very excited about that.
Yeah, it's definitely the longest New Year's resolution I've ever held.
Good point. Quick mention for anyone out there. Thank you to all of our patrons on patreon.com/doubleloop podcast. If you're interested in contributing as well, helping us out with this show, you know, please go to that website and send a couple bucks our way. And with that, Glenn, let's do our Where in the World game.
Right. For another episode of Where in the World, although we are going to have to come up with something new. I'm going to start running out of countries and we're going to get into the, you know, the 20 small countries
sure.
in Africa that would be difficult to name the specific one.
Well, with all the recent newspaper articles about that AI paper that we talked about previously, and maybe we should just rename this segment to Where in the Swirled, right?
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Anyway, yeah,
we'll come back to that pretty soon here. Okay, so the country I've chosen today has three official languages in the country, although none of them are actually named after the particular country.
Okay.
Their national team that they're very proud of, who was number one winner of this particular sport, is named the Red Devils. And when they're playing and the country all gets together to support their team, they color everything red in the country.
Okay.
They claim to have the world's best chocolate, although this is hotly disputed by a number of other countries, especially Switzerland.
Okay, not Switzerland. Good to know. All right.
Right.
I was going to say, I thought they had four countries, languages, but okay.
They're very proud of their chocolatiers, but they believe them to be the best.
Okay.
This is something I have particularly witnessed with a colleague of mine from this country. Their national symbol is a peeing boy. Yes, I'm saying that correctly. He is peeing. He is urinating, and this is their national symbol. Just as the U.S. says the eagle is our national symbol, their national symbol is from a bronze statue of a boy peeing, which, according to local legend, he put out a fire while peeing on it. They are famous for their parades, including a triennial cat parade. That's for Becca. She should plan to go there.
All right.
And the final clue that I think will make it obvious to you, they invented the French fry, the pommes frites, the French fry,
yes.
And they eat it with mayonnaise.
This has got to be Belgium.
You are correct, sir. Well done.
Yes. Quick joke about Belgium. Glenn, do you know the difference between a French kiss and a Belgian kiss?
I do not.
A Belgian kiss is like a French kiss, but it's got a little bit more phlegm.
That's good.
One of the languages than being Flemish that you had mentioned.
Flemish.
Right.
Flemish, right.
Okay.
Well, that's actually not one of their official languages. That surprised me. Yeah, it was French, German, and Dutch are the three official languages. Flemish is a language spoken there, just like English,
sure.
But it's not official. I thought that was interesting. And the peeing boy, that caught me off guard. But a shout out to a colleague of mine, Andy Becue, Dr. Andy Becue from University of Lausanne. When we were in graduate school together, he claimed that the Belgian chocolate is by far the best, better than the Swiss chocolate. This was a constant debate in the office.
I'm not gonna argue either one. I'll just remain undecided and ask for more samples to test.
Oh, very good.
Well, so Glenn, you know, we kind of skipped up ahead in our AI episode. So now this will be releasing here quite a few weeks after that went out. So this is about our first chance to kind of talk about how that's gone over. Seems like we definitely got, you know, a lot of listens on that episode. There's been a lot of conversation continuing in the community. Brand Breedlove with Uncover Forensics has done a presentation, a free webinar about it. I think she's going to do a second one here soon. So definitely struck a nerve and is continuing to be a topic that's coming up throughout the whole community.
Yeah, I mean, the people that seem most interested, of course, are the fingerprint examiners. We can't seem to get anyone in the popular media to actually care about it. But at least the people in our community have listened to it and have given us some great feedback. And I saw some discussions going on about the fact that they interviewed the author on, was it Science NPR the other day?
Science Friday, yeah.
Yeah. And again, I think our instincts were right. I mean, he's definitely still selling something that is beyond what it really is. And he's got the fancy of the popular media, and people aren't really kind of calling out what it is really doing.
The exception, I think, being the article we pointed out from CNN, where the author there really seemed to do his homework in, you know, asking questions to Christoph and to Simon, and you know, getting their, at least their input into the article, in addition to all of the more sensationalist portions.
Yeah, I kind of expected NPR, you know, to maybe do a little better job with right. that.
Yep. Well, we will see how this continues to develop, though. Definitely great to see the whole community preparing for whatever this brings here in the future.
Indeed. So today's episode, I'm excited to introduce a guest that I had the opportunity to see at the IAPS again. So I assume the listeners are now expecting, oh, great, another friggin' Australian I have to listen to and listen to their accent. No, it was an American. There was an American speaker over there. And Eric and I, we both know his name is Steve Johnson. And Steve Johnson is, oh, quite a colorful figure in our professional group, the International Association for Identification. Steve was one of the presidents of the IAI and is now an ex-president. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But he gave a presentation at the IAPS conference on facial recognition. And I have said multiple times on this show, I don't know much about facial recognition. Anytime I've ever been asked to compare faces, I've sucked at it. I'm not good at it. I don't know what to look for. We talked about this in the previous episode with Bethany Grounds. I don't know what the trick is. I don't know what the discriminating characteristics are. I just look at faces and I go, maybe it's him. I can't tell. And what I liked about Steve's talk that I'm sure we'll get to is that there are many conditions that can make it very difficult, whether it's, you know, the resolution of the camera or the angle of the camera or the lighting and all these kind of cool things. And I sat there really interested in this talk. So I reached out to Steve and said, hey, Steve, would you come on and talk about facial recognition on the podcast? And he said, no problem. So with that, we would like to welcome Steve Johnson.
Good night, fellas. I couldn't help myself. I'm sorry. Oh, it's great.
Well played, sir.
Great to be on the show with you too.
Great to have you. So why don't we just jump right in, start off. Steve, want to introduce yourself a little bit more than what Glenn did to the audience.
Yeah, as Glenn said, I've been affiliated with the IAI for too long, over 30 years, and had an opportunity to get involved with the leadership and rose through the ranks, first as a member of the board of directors and then as vice president, eventually president and chair of the board. Seems like a lifetime ago, but it was in 2015. It was the 100th birthday of our organization. We'd been around for 100 years, the oldest forensics practitioner organization in the world. So we're kind of proud of that. And I believe we're probably the largest or darn close to being the largest. So
yeah,
that's my background with the organization. My practitioner background, as far as forensics is concerned, is fingerprint examination, forensic art. Believe it or not, I'm a certified forensic artist on top of everything else, which kind of,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that kind of ties into how the whole facial identification thing started and crime scene, footwear. And I think that's about all I can handle right now.
Wow. I didn't know you were involved in so many disciplines. That's pretty cool.
Like one of the old school jack of all trades that our field that forensics used to have.
Yeah, master of none, but yes, jack of them all for sure.
What organization did you get your start with doing crime scene, fingerprints, et cetera?
So I was a police officer back in the day, just past the horse and buggy era, but I was able to get started in law enforcement in Iowa, just south of where you are, Glenn, a small, well, relatively small municipal police department, Davenport, Iowa. I was hired as a police officer. And typically when you got out of the academy, because you most recently had that 8 hours of crime scene training, you got thrown the keys to the evidence wagon when you finally got out on the street. And I ended up really enjoying processing crime scenes. Shortly thereafter, I was a detective and got involved in some what they call person crimes, robberies, murders, and stuff like that. but had a talent for pattern recognition, as it turns out. I got involved with a gentleman who you may know, Glenn, Dennis Kern and John Kilgore.
Oh, yeah.
Those are names that were pretty big in the business back in the day. Asked me to give fingerprint examination a try, and I was good at it and got certified in that discipline. And also, because I was an artist before I even came on the department, I was asked to do some forensic drawings, some facial sketches. Eventually went through a lot of training for that, got certified in that, served as chair of the Forensic Art Certification Board for a number of years, and I'm a member of that board today. So that's my background up until the present time when facial recognition and facial identification kind of wormed its way into my life.
Fantastic. Okay. I a lot of that I didn't realize, and I didn't realize you'd worked with John as well. And Bridget, too,
I think.
Bridget Lewis?
Yeah. I actually worked for the state lab for just a very short period of time before my current job. So I worked for the state of Iowa Crime Lab with Bridget and John.
Yeah, they were great people.
Yep.
Steve, you still work for Ideal Innovations now,
yes,
right?
I was working for the police department, Davenport Police Department, and an opportunity came up to do some overseas work, some labs that were being deployed in Iraq, some counter IED labs. I went over to Iraq in 2006, did about 18 months in Iraq, setting up a counter IED lab at what we called Sexy Labs, and then eventually moved to CEXC, Sexy. Just want to make sure that's clear. Combined Explosives Exploitation Centers, they call them, or cells. And then they decided there were other elements that were being densely exploited in theater. So they did some non-counter IED labs, and those were called JEF labs, Joint Expeditionary Forensic Facilities, that were developed and deployed by the United States Marine Corps. And I transitioned over to those labs in 2007. Help get them up and off the ground. A lot of good work was done in the Middle East during those periods of time.
Yeah.
And longtime listeners of the show will remember that I briefly, after leaving Arizona before starting with IDEMIO, worked for Ideal Innovations, you know, and for Steve over in West Virginia.
Yes. We couldn't keep our hooks in you, but we tried, Eric.
It was a great experience, great time. I just had an offer I couldn't turn down.
I don't blame you.
Yeah. But no, it's a great work that group does. So Steve, you know, Glenn came back talking about all these different presentations from that conference in Australia. You know, what was the main topic that you were presenting on there?
Well, what I'm trying to bring to the table is the status of facial identification as a discipline, forensic discipline. Facial identification is relatively new in the forensic sciences. However, facial recognition and facial identification has been around since people have had eyes. But to put it into a forensic context is relatively recent. The facial identification scientific working group was formed in 2009. I was a charter member of that SWIG, and it has since gotten a little bit more legs because of the emphasis on facial recognition and in use in the law enforcement community and in the private sector. A lot of people are depending on closed circuit and surveillance cameras to capture images of individuals that may or may not be involved in some nefarious activities. So there's a lot of interest in the science or the discipline right now. And I'm trying to spread the word about where the science is, where the discipline is going, what the future may hold for facial identification. And I want to make sure we clarify, there's a lot of confusion. Some people transpose facial recognition and facial identification. They're basically separate things. Facial recognition is the technology that supports facial identification as a discipline. So the computer, the algorithms that actually generate a lead, much like an AVIS or an APHIS system does with fingerprints, is what the facial recognition technology is. Facial identification are the individuals actually doing the comparison. They're taking the data that is returned from the system and conducting manual comparisons to confirm the identifications or the likelihood of identification.
When a facial examiner reaches a conclusion, what are some of the conclusions that they can reach? Do they actually reach what's called an identification or an exclusion, or do you have your own scale for reporting out conclusions?
That's a good question, Glenn. There's no set scale that's accepted by the community right now. There are scales that are, it is, it isn't, and they're undecided. There's scales that range from strong support for, some support for, common source, And then the other side of that is, of course, support for or strong support for not the same source. So, and that scale can, I've seen 11-point scales, if you can imagine that.
I can.
Yeah.
I cannot.
We actually work with a 5-point scale, strong support mm-hmm. for, support for on the positive side with inconclusive in the middle and support for and strong support for on the other side. We do not go all the way to the level of identification. I know mm-hmm. identification gets a bad rap as far as a term because we can't say, you know, to the exclusion of all others, but we can certainly come up with a significant level of confidence in our opinion.
Are these used as confirmatory measures or leads in investigations? Is there ever a situation where this would represent a positive identification that we are definitively identifying this person by face?
No, we are very firm in our assertion that this should only be used as an investigative lead for law enforcement purposes.
So it may still go into court, but there is still that caveat placed on the decision.
Yes. And that's included in, it should be included as a disclaimer in any report that you generate is our recommendation.
So why is that? Why not go all the way to an identification and stick with these results as being investigative leads?
Well, we feel the tendency in the sciences is to steer clear of anything that's definitive when it comes to making a decision. You know, the question is, well, can you be sure there's not a doppelganger out there that doesn't look exactly like the person you're discussing? And we can't. We don't have that. We don't have access to those resources. So we can make as strong a claim as we can based on our skills, knowledge, and abilities as to whether we are confident in our conclusion. You know, for strong, frankly, strong support for is as close to identification as we can get.
Sure.
So what are some of the characteristics that a facial examiner might use in their examination? Because, I mean, as a layperson, you know, obviously I think of hair color, eye color, and the very simple, obvious sort of demographic characteristics. But what I believe that there are some that I've never even thought about comparing from source to source. What are some of those more discriminating characteristics?
Well, one of the documents that the Facial Identification Scientific Working Group, FISWIG for short, came up with and is now a standard is a morphological analysis checklist. We've developed 18 features of the face that we look at with a number of sub-features. It actually gets into dozens of sub-features that are looked at. But the 18 features that we consider are the overall shape, the outline, if you will, of the head and face, the positions of the features on the face themselves, or facial composition, the eyes and nose and the mouth and how they relate to each other, the hair, facial hair, nose, mouth, eyes, lines on the face, the neck, believe it or not, is considered part of the face. The ears are extremely helpful in identification because they're very unique from person to person, believe it or not. We really, really love the opportunity to look at ears when we do a comparison. And we can consider these 18 elements and we check through them as we go through an examination process to determine, based on our comparisons, the likelihood that this is the same person or not.
Do you use tools for measurement, you know, like measuring, for example, the distance between eyes, or are you using human judgment and trying to assess those distances?
The only time measurements come into play is usually at the algorithmic level. There are minimum requirements for a lot of the algorithms that do facial comparison algorithmically. And that distance between the corners of the eyes or distance between the pupils becomes a factor. It's hard for us to use measurements because, by and large, the images we're looking at don't have a scale for us to really determine the actual distance between two features. I mean, we might note that the eyes appear farther apart or the eyes are or closer together. Those kind of things can be articulated as an opinion, but we don't get into physical measurements.
Right. So much like fingerprints, it's sort of a sense, a training on these, a sense of distances between things. Is it intolerance or out of tolerance?
Right.
Much like in fingerprints.
Yes.
Yeah, Glenn, you know, I took a class from Steve, 40-hour class on face when I was still working for I3. And so, yeah, if any fingerprint examiners out there are interested, definitely encourage at least, you know, an intro class to see just how this all works. I think even that 40-hour class, I mean, I never got to the point where I was doing it as a part of actual casework, but as an introduction of here's all the things, the elements of the face that you're looking at, it does force you to, or give you the ability to step away from just that looking at the entire face and then start to focus in on this element and this element and this element, and you're breaking it down into those individual separate things and seeing where there might be differences or similarities. I found it really interesting.
We try to give a lot of opportunity for the community to see it at different levels of expertise. We have a very high level overview of facial examination. And then you get really into the weeds, Eric. When you get into that 40-hour class, that's a pretty intense hands-on comparative analysis kind of approach to the discipline. So you obviously took that class, and that's a little bit more of a deep dive. But we've gone to a 4-hour intro, just here's what facial identification is all about. So people that want to understand the process certainly have an opportunity to do that.
Yeah, if you see that available at an II conference or, you know, any other conference that you might go to, I think you'd encourage fingerprint examiners to take a look and see, you know, what they think about that and how, you know, it's just another kind of comparison thing that you can judge how good you are at this compared to the fingerprints you're used to comparing.
Indeed.
So, Steve, are there any error rate studies, or have there been any studies done, maybe even comparing performance against lay people, novices, against experts to compare their overall performance?
There's been some studies done by Dr. Jonathan Phillips at the National Institute of Standards and Technology regarding the effectiveness of people that are trained to do this kind of work versus layperson versus latent print examiners, believe it or not. So there is some research out there. I don't have the numbers, but I do know Patrick Grother. I don't know if you're familiar with Patrick, but he's also a NIST scientist, and he conducts what was the facial recognition vendor testing every year. They've since separated it out into two different testing elements, but his acknowledgement was that you put a very good algorithm together with a highly skilled and trained examiner, the accuracy is approaching the high 90th percentile.
Okay. Well, all right. That's reassuring.
So, Steve, let's back up here for a second, and just I want to ask about the different use cases for facial identification, facial recognition. Where and how is this technology, and how are these comparisons being used? Is it take a video, or you find a video, of a potential crime, or what are the different scenarios that bring in evidence for face examiners to work on?
Well, there's certainly a number of elements that can contribute to the request for facial comparison, but most commonly it's the surveillance camera, as you mentioned, that picks up the suspect in the commission of or thereafter a crime, or perhaps it's a subject of interest based on pocket litter, a photo of somebody that they believe might be connected to a situation. They want to confirm after submitting that image into a known database of individuals, whether the person that was generated by the algorithm is consistent with the probe that was submitted. And that's where an examination will take place. And that would be what we call the examiner level comparison. Similar to friction ridge, there are two levels of the most interest in the facial identification discipline. The examiner level would be consistent with the latent print examiner. It's a much more difficult comparison. You're looking at perhaps a very poor image of the latent print, correct? Similarly, a facial examiner will be looking at a poor image of a subject, a surveillance camera, bad angle, poor lighting, some of the things that were discussed earlier. So that's the highest level of comparison. The other element is a reviewer, and that would be similar to a 10-print examiner. In other words, you're looking at a subject that's been apprehended or has been detained, and you're submitting that subject's image into a database, and you're going to determine whether or not that person has been apprehended before. Is there a prior record of this subject? Not as challenging because you're looking at controlled capture of the probe, against a controlled capture of the subject from prior contact. Does that make sense?
So, yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Controlled to controlled.
Yes.
Under the most ideal lighting conditions and probably a standard view, like looking forward and profile to the side and captured under standard conditions.
Ideally, yes.
Ideally.
Ideally.
Just like 10 print records, right?
Right. Yeah.
There's
they don't always they're supposed to look. Good as we've seen latent prints that are way better than 10 prints, for sure.
Exactly. But more to the point, this technology is, and these comparisons are, you know, really focused on post-event captures, videos or images. A crime happens, they go pull the security cameras, they submit the recordings for comparisons or for search. It's not like a live tracking of, you know, who's walking down the street kind of technology.
We certainly don't advocate that. I'm not saying that doesn't go on at right. some levels. I don't know what's going on in the background. We don't advocate that. It's very difficult to capture live and make decisions live, but there may be, depending on the circumstances, some need for that. Our focus and the work that we do is always post-event.
When you have the individual, obviously, and you're taking photographs under these more controlled conditions, I mean, wouldn't they just take fingerprints as well?
Oh, absolutely. But fingerprints may not be present at the scene of the crime. So it may be necessary to utilize this as a more confirmatory element.
If there's nothing to compare the fingerprints to. Makes sense. Okay.
So what are some of the misconceptions that the public has about face comparisons or facial recognition?
Wow. There's a lot. I don't think there's any. Well, there are. I mean, everybody's got the big brother's watching factor.
Sure.
You know, people, we are the most, and rightly so, the most privacy, a strong.
Sensitive.
Yeah. Sensitive country in the world, as far as I'm concerned. We are very serious about a person's privacy. We try to protect that as much as we can. Hardly a day goes by where you don't see something negative about facial rec improperly used or wrongfully used, intentionally wrongfully used. In other words, they're looking at somebody that had no business being looked at. They were using people's driver's license photos to develop a search. So there was a case, I won't say what department was involved, but they were using a driver's license photo of an individual. The machine said it could be this person. The detective took it upon themselves to say it was the person. That person was arrested. Right. It wasn't him. And this guy, you know, he was only in jail for a little while, but it doesn't land. That doesn't matter, right? He was in jail and he shouldn't have been. So clearly, there's got to be checks and balances when you utilize this technology. Part of that checks and balance is having somebody that knows what they're doing with the data. It's one thing to let the machine say, yeah, this is the guy, but you know, would no sooner take a number one hit on a APHIS machine and say, the machine said it's the guy, that's the guy. You need a latent print examiner to confirm that decision. And that's what the facial examiner and the facial reviewer do.
When they have a review system, do they also use blinding schemes, for example, where the second examiner or verifier may not necessarily know the conclusions of the first?
Yes.
Do you have some sort of protocols for that?
Yes, we follow a very similar protocol that a lot of latent examiners do. We follow an ACP protocol. We have a second verifier look at the same data independent of the initial examiner and draw their own conclusions.
So it seems like this is really expanding over the past even 5-10 years, and it's continuing to expand. So there's like a lot of new examiners moving into this discipline. Who are agencies tapping to be face examiners? You know, are they new hires? Are they cops? Are they fingerprint examiners? Like where are the people doing this work coming from?
Well, believe it or not, a lot of the federal government agencies are utilizing facial recognition technology. There was a recent report that came out from the GAO that listed a number of federal agencies that have facial recognition technology in use, but maybe not the training necessarily to use it properly. The Government Accounting Office conducted a study about the use of facial recognition technology in the federal government. And I'm not going to get into the weeds, but it's out there. It came out last September, basically encouraging these agencies, if you're going to have facial recognition technology, make sure people are properly trained to use the technology. The bottom line, there are a lot of organizations, even at the corporate level, people that are worried about loss prevention, for instance, are capturing individuals that may be engaged in shoplifting or other criminal activity in a commercial enterprise, and they want to determine who those people are, if nothing else, to be a watchful of them the next time they come into the store, or use that as a reason to ban them from future attempts to come into the store. I'm sure that the intel community is using facial recognition technology as much as they possibly can to identify people that are a threat to our country. So there's a myriad of folks that are utilizing the technology. I started the facial identification subcommittee with the IAI back in 2014 when I was in the leadership, because I saw this as an emerging discipline and it could utilize some of the people involved in the practice to come up with standards and to come up with a potential certification for facial identification. So since that time, we've seen an explosion in the use of facial recognition technology because the algorithms continue to get more accurate. In the early 90s, when facial recognition technology really took off, 67% was considered a good accuracy level for the algorithms. That, with high quality controlled capture, they're at the iris level of accuracy. And iris is in the 99th percentile. Controlled capture images that are submitted into a database against other controlled captures are at the 99th percentile of accuracy now. These algorithms are that good.
Wow.
Yeah, they, like you said, those NIST results are just kind of crazy. I think there are a lot of the companies invested during the pandemic into improving face algorithms in the expectation that face coverings would be kind of with us for a while.
Yeah.
And I mean, they were for a bit, but you know, it's not nearly as common anymore. But because of that push of not now covering half the face and still making an ID,
yeah,
it's got crazy. Like, they're comparing side view and having high accuracy even there.
That is really scary. I mean, scary good, because I would never in my wildest dreams have thought that you could do that kind of comparison with any degree of accuracy 10 years ago. Just wasn't going to happen. But it's definitely gone up considerably. And the AI that they're using to create the algorithms is certainly making it a lot more accurate as a result.
And you haven't even hired anybody from Columbia University to work on that AI.
We digress.
So you talked about AI and your work in starting up that subcommittee back 10 years ago now. What about the certification program for face examiners?
Yeah, that's a great question, Eric. As you know, the AI is predominantly known as a certifying organization, although with the creation of the Forensic Certification Management Board, they separated themselves from the organization itself to provide that level of independence. So the Forensic Certification Management Board controls the 8 forensic disciplines that are now AI disciplines that offer certification. When we created the Facial Identification Subcommittee, our intent was not only to help develop standards and to provide expertise in the field, but to look at the possibility or the viability of a certification for facial identification. And we have submitted a proposal to the Forensic Certification Management Board. It was presented prior to last year's conference in National Harbor. The director is in possession of that proposal. We've had some back and forth with her on what she feels we need to do to make it a more viable proposal for consideration. One thing we did bring to the table pursuant to the FCMB, Forensic Certification Management Board's operations manual, was we answered all the questions about why. Is there a need? Yes. Is there a demand? Yes. Is there anybody else doing this? No. So those questions were answered. And is it sustainable? In other words, are there enough people out there in the discipline that it makes it worthwhile for the organization to offer a certification? We don't want to offer a certification and only 8 people get certified. So what we did was we sent out a survey. It started out very, wasn't professional. We just reached out to the community. Hey, if you are doing this as part of your job, or if you're aware of this being used in your organization, please let us know and how many people are doing it. Well, when it happened, it just took off. It was a wildfire. It went around the world. We ended up getting responses from well over 100 organizations that say they're using facial identification as part of their operations. And when we totaled it all up on the numbers of people that are either interested in or be would consider getting certified, it was anywhere from between 300 and 800 people right out of the chute that would be interested in getting certified in this discipline, which, as you know, that would be a lot of people getting certified as an opening salvo in this discipline. The reason for the disparity in the the numbers is we gave them a range for how many people in your organization, 1 to 10, 10 to 20, that kind of thing. So we took the low and the high side, assuming that could be the range, and that was our range for the number of people that would potentially get certified.
So probably somewhere in the middle, but still.
Yeah, I think 500 to 600, yeah, would be an average that would be reasonable. Yeah.
And that probably, I mean, that puts it above some of the existing certifications.
It would come in as the third largest certifying discipline in the organization with an initial launch, yes.
That's fantastic. That's a fantastic response. From my position, it seems like there's a lot of agencies that now have this technology available and are wanting to know, what do we do next?
Right.
And who's going to be using it? Who are going to be the users of this? So, yeah, I definitely see the importance of having this process set up to ensure that the users of the system, the people making these decisions, you know, have the proper training.
Exactly.
And experience.
Exactly.
So you and Eric both talked about courses that examiners can take to learn how to do this and improve their skills. Are there any textbooks, like standard manuals or sort of a source book for facial recognition? Is there a certain author or book in the industry that's sort of recommended for every junior examiner?
Well, there are no source books as of yet. A source book is in development, believe it or not. We are at the earliest stages of that effort. There are a number of standards that are out there, either in development or that have been published. And our focus for the training for any kind of a certification would be on those standards because, one, they're freely available, which is always nice when you're getting your references together to prepare for a certification program. There are some other textbooks that are available. I don't have them in front of me. I don't want to reveal them just yet because the program is still in the proposal stage, and that would be unfair to those are people that might be interested in this to get a head start. But the bottom line, we are putting together a list of references that would assist these people that would want to get certified in the discipline once and if it's, of course, accepted.
Oh, and then the other question I had was, when designing tests for facial examiners, I know how we can get fingerprint samples, but how do you get facial samples for these kinds of tests, especially given that it shows the person, the donor? How do you deal with those kinds of
issues? It is extremely, extremely challenging. Clearly, we have to get the permission of the folks that are being utilized as candidates and probes for any kind of a practical examination. We have
children, I imagine, would be a difficult one to get as well.
It requires permission from parents of those children. We have a pretty good cross section of faces that we're working with. We have submitted a number of examples of those practical images as part of our proposal, as required by the FCMB. So we're hopeful that gives the powers that be that will make the decision on whether a certification program can be launched, the information they need to allow that to happen.
Is there ever a need for volunteers? Is there ever a need for volunteers for people like, hey, I'm willing to give my image or me and my friends or me and my children? Do you guys ever have requests out to either the forensic community or law enforcement community? Hey, we need images. We need data sets.
Yeah.
Here.
As a matter of fact, the last couple of conferences of the IAI, we've provided people an opportunity to win a prize if they're willing to share their image. We take images of them at the conference. We encourage them to come back throughout the course of the conference to get different, maybe clothing, different looks. And then we'll reach out to them thereafter. And do you have photos that you're willing to share, family photos, things like that, that would allow us to continue to build that database. So we've done those kind of things. We've worked with the IAI as a vendor to try and collect that kind of data.
Steve, I have one more question about facial. Do you have an enhanced button on your computer? Because every movie I've ever seen, all you have to do is hit the enhanced button. You do have the enhanced button, right?
just like CSI, everything is so simple. And those perfect prints that pop up when you launch those into the APHIS system are just like that with face. No, that, I mean, we do work with some kind of imaging software that helps us maybe soften or sharpen an image. But we have to deal with the image quality is certainly a matter of course when we do comparisons. And that is actually part of the training that folks get. It's not just looking at faces, but what our image is impacted by the way it's taken, the lighting, things like that are all part of the training. So,
Glenn, an enhanced button. I mean, that's so last century. You gotta just say the word enhance.
Just insane.
Right?
Enhance.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Zoom
and enhance.
And wave my hand.
Yes.
Wave my hand, yes. Skimming through the images.
And rotate 360. Don't forget that.
That's right. Since we were talking a little bit about the II, we've never really had the opportunity to speak to someone with your credentials of the II. Having an ex-president here on the show, we just thought it would take a moment to actually talk a little bit about the II, what that organization is, and what it might offer to people who are interested, if they're not already members of the II, but particularly if they wanted to get involved in the IAI.
Certainly.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
I'd love to. I think the IAI is the best kept secret in forensics right now. I think we do need to do a little bit better job of tooting our own horn. We are the oldest forensics practitioner organization in the world, again, formed in 1915. And we represent a lot of disciplines and certify in 8 of those disciplines. 7,000 plus members in over 50 countries with 40 different divisions. And I'm probably low on the number of countries that are involved. It is international. It is the International Association for Identification. I got involved first as a divisional member. I was part of the Iowa division. It's one of those many divisions. And then was asked to go to an international conference in Milwaukee way back when. And I really fell in love with the organization. It's an opportunity for practitioners to get together, learn something, network with other practitioners. One thing I love about the IAI's conference, its annual conference, is there's a lot of hands-on workshops that give you a chance to really get involved with a specific discipline that you have some interest in. So people who are involved in forensic science should look at the organization, see what it offers. It's a relatively affordable membership. As membership in organizations go, it's $80 a year. If you're from another country outside the U.S., we've lowered that. The international rate is $45 a year.
Oh, wow.
If you look at other organizations that are out there, and they're great organizations, don't get me wrong, but $150, $200 a year is pretty typical for some of the other organizations. So I think the IAI is a real bargain. And if you are in a discipline that the IAI certifies, you can get certified as a member for $300. And that certification, assuming you pass, is good for 5 years. There is no better bargain than that. That's, $60 a year. So it's a great organization from a sharing, networking, training perspective. It's really a kind of a blue collar organization. It is the practitioners that support the organization by and large. And I love it. I've been a member for a very long time, probably longer than you've been born, Glenn. But a long time, and I know you and Eric are members, and I've met you through the organization and have become good friends with both of you as a result. And I think that's just a microcosm of what the whole organization represents, that ability to meet people, network, and become good friends and share information and knowledge.
Well, I would definitely agree with that. I go to the IAI now just to see friends. It's like a family reunion for me, and I really enjoy that. So if I was attending the IAI, let's say for the first time or second time, maybe even third time, a little newer to the field, and I wanted to get involved in something, I see that there are these different committees or these different groups that are part of the planning of the IAI or science and practices committees. Like, how would I go about even getting noticed in some way or applying for that? What would you recommend?
Well, I think if you renew your membership, you can certainly indicate in your membership renewal interest in participating or be a part of a committee. As a new member, you can also indicate your interest in the application for membership. Engage with the people that are involved in whatever discipline you are interested in. Most of the subcommittees, the science and practices subcommittees that you mentioned, have open meetings at the conference every year. I encourage people to come to those open meetings. They're on the agenda. There's no secrets there. ask questions, get involved, get to know some of the people that are on these committees. The IAI leadership encourages people to participate and engage with these committees. We'd like to see new people involved in these science and practices and certifications. So I would encourage anybody that's got an interest in the organization or has had a chance to attend the conference to just step up, introduce yourself. One of the great things we've done in the last, I want to say 10 years or so, we have this new first-time attendees party on the Sunday night before the president's reception. And it gives people an opportunity to meet the leadership, get to know some of the folks that are running the organization and recognize them as just average Joes, just like them, that work just like they do. They just happen to have a title in front of their name, but it makes them no different or no better and kind of brings everything a little bit more into that family atmosphere that you referenced earlier, Glenn.
So a little bit of a misconception is that you don't necessarily have to do a presentation at the IAI or multiple presentations to join a committee or get involved in some way. You could actually focus more on that as opposed to presenting or doing workshops, lectures, et cetera.
I know a number of people, that's a good point, Glenn. I know a number of people that are not comfortable in that classroom setting or that presentation mode, but they've got a lot of knowledge and they've got a lot to offer and they have been involved at the subcommittee or certification level. Definitely qualifies them to be a part of the organization in that way, for sure.
Great.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for coming on. Glad we got to talk about space identification stuff and the IAI stuff. It's just been great talking with you. And thank you for coming on and sharing all that with us.
My pleasure. I really enjoyed the time with you both. You guys are great friends, and you're doing a great job with the Devil Loop. I'm looking forward to this and other programs that you guys present.
Thanks, Steve.
Well, Glenn, do you have some classes coming up here in the new year?
I do. I have a Practical Answers to Challenging Questions in the Courtroom. That's the class I teach with Carrie Hall and Brendan Max. It's about difficult scenarios and questions in the courtroom, a 3-day class. That will be May 6th through May 8th in Irvine, California. And then the 2 months later or 3 months later, I'll be teaching advanced ACV applications for fingerprint examiners. That's the advanced ACV class I teach. Also in Southern California, that's Beverly Hills, California. I'll be in SoCal a lot, yes. But that means Magic Castle trips for anyone who wants to go to the Magic Castle in that class. So go to ronsmithandassociates.com to register for those classes. And if you're interested in webinars, I have a whole series this spring. Please go to evolveforensics.com for those webinars.
And I have my class now set. So coming up April 15th through the 19th, I'll be teaching latent print exclusions and APHIS solutions. And that's going to be in, let's see if I can get this right, Schwanksville, Pennsylvania, which is just outside of Philadelphia, but Schwanksville is the actual name of the town. So email me, eric@rayforensics.com for questions about that. You should be able to find it by searching for the name of the class, latent print exclusions and APHIS solutions. Maybe throw in IDEMIA, since the class is being provided through IDEMIA, to register for the class, and hope to see you there. And Glenn, I'll be seeing you at the court class there in Southern California in May. I've registered for that one. So
fantastic.
Excited to see you there. And
Magic Castle, baby.
Magic Castle, exactly. Excited for that trip as well. Well, if you guys have any questions for us or anything you want us to forward on to Steve, you can send us an email, glenn@eliteforensicservices.com or eric@rayforensics.com. Our website, wloopodcast.com, has links to older episodes, our merchandise store, links to the Patreon page. You can support us there, all that kind of stuff. I remember that the opinions expressed in the show are those of the speaker, not necessarily anyone that they work for. And with that, close out and say goodbye and talk to you guys next time.
Bye, everybody. Have a great week.